Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and the following interview is being republished from the Classical Ideas podcast. This is a podcast run by Greg Soden, and it's absolutely terrific. If you like the NBN, I'm sure that you'll like Classical Ideas. You can find it at classicalideaspodcast.libsyn.com or on iTunes. I hope you enjoy the following interview.
This is Classical Ideas with Greg Soden. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. A prolific author and speaker, Alan Watts was one of the first to interpret Eastern wisdom for a Western audience. Born outside London in 1915, he discovered the nearby Buddhist Lodge at a young age. After moving to the United States in 1938, Alan became an Episcopal priest for a time and then relocated to Millbrook, New York, where he wrote his pivotal book, The Wisdom of Insecurity: A Message for an Age of Anxiety. In 1951, he moved to San Francisco, where he began teaching Buddhist studies, and in 1956 began his popular radio show, Way Beyond the West. By the early 60s, Alan's radio talks aired nationally, and the counterculture movement adopted him as a spiritual spokesperson. He wrote and traveled regularly until his passing in 1973. You can find information on his work at www.alanwatts.org. My guest today is Alan's eldest daughter, Joan Watts. She is the co-editor, along with her sister Anne, of the new volume, The Collected Letters of Alan Watts, out now from New World Library. Today we are discussing the life of Alan Watts, part one in my series with Joan and Anne Watts. Without further delay, I bring you Joan Watts. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. I am here today with Joan Watts, who is one of the editors of the new volume, The Collected Letters of Alan Watts. So, Joan, thank you so much for coming on Classical Ideas.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, I want to start off by just kind of talking about the fact that we just passed the 44th anniversary of the passing of Alan Watts, your father. And I'm a high school teacher, so I'm always curious what people want to convey about the topics that they're interested in. So if you were to stand in front of a room of American teenagers, what do you think would be the most important thing for them to know about Alan Watts and his work?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that question, because I had the opportunity to actually do that back at the end of October. I was asked to be a distinguished speaker at the now the Besant Hill School of Happy Valley in Ojai, California, that I attended. And so So I was speaking in front of a group of teenagers. And I think, you know, right now, a lot of what Alan wrote, especially in his letters, is so relevant to the things that are happening today. And I think that I'm seeing more young people turn, especially 20s and 30s, to his work. But I'm also surprised with the teenagers that are. I had one teen came up to me at the end of my discussion there, and he was clutching a book that he had read of Alan's, Cloud Hidden, Whereabouts Unknown, when he was 11 years old, and he was now 17 and had read all of Alan's books. Great surprise.
Indeed.
So I dutifully autographed his book for him, and you know, he was just a very normal looking kid, you know, so just concerned about the future and the trend of things in the world.
So you've got this new collection out, and it's quite a tome, and it, I read the whole thing and I absolutely loved it, and I'm curious if you can set the stage for this massive letters collection. So what does the archive of Alan Watts look like? Where is it? Where is it stored? Is it messy, organized? So can you describe what we would be looking at if we saw the scope of the project that you and Anne were facing down?
Well, it sits in my office, or at least the correspondence and so on, a portion of it does. All his books went to the California Institute of Integral Studies. So his library collection went there, but his personal letters and manuscripts and so on, my sister and I inherited when his widow died in 1992. And quite frankly, it was a mess. They had been stored in a storage area in Mill Valley, California, actually, where there had been a flood, and so a lot of papers were damaged. And I hired a nice young woman that had worked for me previously to help us go through and sort out what was still readable and what was important and so on, and create a useful file. It's basically two legal drawers, a file cabinet with two full-size legal drawers in it. And Alan made copious copies of his letters. I mean, he would I think, probably for remembering what he said to the person more than anything else. And so we had many carbon copies to go through. And he also wrote to his parents, and that was a great find. I didn't realize that that was in the file until we started really going through it. It was amazing because he wrote to his parents almost every month during the course of his life. His father died a year after he did, so you can imagine the scope of letters that were there. And those were all original copies because his parents saved every single one of his letters from the time he went to school as a boy at age 13, I think, are the earliest letters we found. And all of that, when we started going through them, there were probably well over 600 and some letters that we went through and basically chose ones that we thought would be of most interest to people.
Do you know the...
And then we had to, of course, scan and put them into Word format and do that whole thing, copy edit everything. So it was quite a process.
Do you know how many letters you did include in the book out of the 600 plus that you had to work with?
I think there's about 400 letters in the book.
Yeah, it was really quite a remarkable project. In the drawers, in the files, were there the original responses and letters from Alan's parents to him as well?
Some, yes. And certainly some of the letters to the individuals that he wrote to in there were also responses.
I would imagine that's a pretty cherished thing for you.
Right. Yeah. And I guess with the publisher, we decided to only do the letters that he wrote because it would be so difficult at this point in time to get permission to publish the letters that people wrote to him.
Fantastic. So the book goes through many different eras of his life, basically from the beginning until the very end. And one of the sections that I really latched onto were his years as a priest, because I've never really thought of Alan as like a Christian scholar. I've always been exposed to him through his Eastern philosophy and his work with the Tao and Zen mostly. So even though he was in the church for a long time, so his Christian roots seemed just as strong as his Buddhist roots. So Alan's young years seem to describe an experience of deep Christianity, but he also seems to find Christian curriculum sort of boring, but then he branched into Zen when he was very young. And so as a modern Westerner, I fit that 30s demographic that you talked about, who finds Alan's work very compelling and also his Eastern work very compelling. So is it surprising to you that Alan went from Christianity to Buddhism and then back to Christianity before finally settling in Buddhism?
It was surprising. I, you know, of course, during that period of time, I was a young girl, so my grasp of it in that era was not particularly involved there. But in reading over his letters, especially his letters regarding Christian doctrine, I constantly felt like he was weighing the Christian thought with Eastern thought and not quite totally buying into the Christian doctrine. And it didn't surprise me, you know, that he would eventually leave the church. But it was interesting how he got into it so heavily. He seemed to be very much into the ritual, I want to say pomp and circumstance almost, because it was very much like that. I remember attending Mass when he was presiding over the altar, and he took it very, very seriously, and it was always very elegantly done. His Mass, his sermons, you know, and high I want to say like Christmas and Easter and high holidays, or that's not quite the right word for it. He would, you know, really go all out. And people seemed to really enjoy that. The parishioners that gathered around were just enthralled with it. And he got to take part in other ecumenical services with places like the Greek Orthodox Church in Chicago, or the Russian Orthodox, and several other interesting places that were very interested in his views of the rites of the religious orders and so on.
Yeah, so he seems, you know, so basically what you're saying is he took it very seriously. He took his role as a priest very seriously, but he also seems to have this undercurrent of questioning and a conflicted mindset of what the teachings are. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Yes, I think that's about it. I think possibly partially because the Eastern philosophy was so much more relaxed, if that would be a term for it, compared to Catholicism or other Christian doctrine, where everything was very rigid, rules.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was part of it.
Do you think, like, what was he, what was his mood like whenever he was a priest? Like, was he kind of like a, because, you know, I've seen his lectures on YouTube and things like that, but mm-hmm. I don't really, but you knew him personally. So whenever he was taking his priestly duties really, really seriously, like, how was he around the house? Was he like taking things very seriously and that in his mood, or was he kind of, you know, was he different in his role as a priest and as like a dad?
Oh, I would say he was different. He, you know, he was, you know, and as a priest, it was serious business. As a dad, it was fun. I mean, you know, he was always kind of playful and, you know, involved with our activities and so on. And he went on that way for our first, the first 10 years of my life, anyway, the first 6 years of my sister's life. And then, you know, once he left the church and he started being much more sought after, lectures, traveling, all of that. Of course, we were both sent off to private school, so we didn't see him very much except on vacations. And so, you know, that was kind of, that was the tipping point where, you know, we had the full access to him and then we didn't have access to him. So that was... But he was always he always enjoyed life pretty much, I think, and was kind of a bon vivant in many ways.
Beautiful. So I watched in the book as he justifies becoming a priest, and he talks about how everything that he can say can be said through Christian theology. And then mm-hmm. in the book, he also seems very mentally conflicted after he gets into the priesthood. So he seems conflicted with his choice almost immediately in the letters, and he's critiquing the standards of the graduate school. He says the congregations are bored. And then he also talks a lot about how he misses New York, the publishing world, his Wisdom of the East series. So these are like, I've felt these things before, like in my own personal life, like whenever I'm doubting the choices that I've made. So I was like, oh my goodness, this is like the exact same things that I've faced in my own
yeah.
life. So these hints clue me into a man having like a crisis of confidence. And he seems to be expressing some regret over these choices to enter the church and these constant referring back to his previous life. So as you were reading these letters, years and years later, what did you learn watching Alan wrestle on the page with his decisions to become a priest?
Well, I just felt that somehow he had talked himself into something that he didn't really believe in, and you know, at one point in the book, it was like, because I consider myself basically an agnostic or non-believer in God. I just got to a point where I said, enough already, you know, stop trying to convince yourself that this is what you believe. And, you know, I just felt that that was very prevalent somehow in his thinking was, and I'm not sure he ever actually got away from thinking that there was a supreme being. I you know, because he sort of continued to refer to that off and on as he continued throughout his life, and especially being still in contact with some of the people, more interesting people involved in Christian doctrine and in the church.
And then when he left, like, he seemed to leave like a flurry of criticism. Like, one of my favorite quotes in the book is when he says, "I am now fully persuaded that the church's claim to be the best of all ways to God is not only a mistake, but also a symptom of anxiety." So do you think he felt foolish for taking this path in the first place? Or, like, did he have good things to say about the church or Christianity in, like, his later years in your own personal conversations with him?
Well, you know, there's a letter in there that he wrote to me when I was marrying a Catholic.
And, yeah.
It was kind of interesting because, you know, he was warning me of the pitfalls, and of course the pitfalls bore out. And, I think, he still for himself you know, I think he thought for some people the church was fine, but for himself it was not. And because he wanted to lead a less restricted life. His lifestyle was definitely what plummeted him out of the church. I think that was his feeling was basically that I can't be free to be the person I want to be and be committed to this type of philosophy.
And one of those problems would be his differing views on like marriage structure, right?
Right, definitely.
Do you think Alan's predictions on marriage and the unbending views of the church being a problem for the church's future, do you think those problems have manifested in today's society?
Oh, definitely. I think so.
So how was he kind of a prophet whenever he was like sort of calling for like that this would happen? Because he foretold the future in several ways in the letters.
He did. Yeah, and not just in regards to marriage, but in a lot of other things. I mean, you look at the drug years and so on, and how he was promoting the legalization of marijuana, and here we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, for one thing, he was very much against what he called sumptuary laws, and there were certain things that you should be able to do in your life that didn't affect other people. That if it was for your benefit and you felt that was your drive, then you should be allowed to do that. So, you know, that was kind of his general philosophy.
So if you think about, so Alan left the church pretty early in his life. He still had many years of life after he left the church. So what do you think Alan offered the Christian world that nobody else could give?
Well, probably a better perspective of what it really means. And, you know, also I think he felt that the way the church was going, all the mystery was being taken out of it, that, you know, changing from Latin to English or, you know, facing the congregation instead of with your back to them. All of those things that were sort of implied from ages before kind of disappeared. And so it was becoming just kind of very ordinary and not mysterious. And I think, you know, the mystery of it was sort of the magic to it was what he felt. And that was kind of lost. And I don't know. You know, I think that not being a member of the church myself, it's hard for me to say whether the things that happened that changed the church so dramatically in the 60s, for instance, would still be happening today is basically what I want to say. So
I was just amazed that so many things that he thought when he was leaving seemed to have continued to be a problem in the church to this day. It was just so many little points of prescience. So let's talk about something a little more joyful for a second. There were a lot of letters where he was describing you and talking about you in your early years, you as a baby, you as a newborn, as a toddler, growing up. And I even see that your personal handwriting appeared in a letter to your grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
What is your favorite thing that you discovered about yourself as in your earliest years from Alan's letters?
Well, I think my most amused feelings was the letter he wrote about my birth, which I just thought was hysterical.
Yeah, you were squawking, right?
Yeah, and he couldn't refer to me as a girl. You referred to me as it throughout the letter. you could tell. I mean, he was only 23 when I was born, so, you know, not having had any siblings, he had no experience that I know of with young children, and so it was quite an episode for him to suddenly have this little thing that squawked and drooled and made bubbles and so on. Being the first child, maybe it's an advantage, I don't know, but he certainly did spend a lot of time talking about my progress, what I did, how I grew up, what I did when I got older, and so on. And not nearly as much mention was made of his other children. I think my sister found that particularly disappointing in the process of doing the book. It was kind of hard for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt almost embarrassed to an extent of his compliments of me and so on. There's very little mention of his five children that he had in his second marriage. Occasionally he would say something about them, but not a whole lot. And I know it was just interesting to see that. But as I say, I think it's kind of more that perspective of the first child and how amazing it is, you know, once you start having more children, then it's kind of rote.
I would imagine that the experience for the book was much different for you than for Anne. I'm looking forward to talking to her as well about the differences.
Yeah, very different, right.
So do you have the letter that he included your handwriting in?
I'm not sure which letter it is, but if it was a letter to his parents, yes.
Excellent. Yeah, there was one in there where it says, where there was just some symbols, and then he said, that is Joan's contribution to the letter. So I can only assume that it would have been your handwriting, and it's actually in the original letter.
I recall what you're saying now. He had typed the letter to his parents.
Oh, okay.
And so it was typewritten. My message was written on the typewriter.
Gotcha. I'd imagine that most of your early memories of Alan would be of him doing some kind of writing, wouldn't it? Like putting together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was pretty much at a typewriter most of the time, and that's why one of the things I loved about the cover that was designed for the book was the typewriter in it, because that was it.
Is that his actual typewriter on the cover of the book?
Oh, I don't think so. No, definitely not.
Oh, okay.
Definitely sort of the era, because he was writing in the days prior to computers and even typewriters that had some memory in them and so on. He never had anything like that.
So last weekend, I went to my first Zen retreat in Kansas, and it was really kind of an amazing experience. So I'm a religious studies teacher, which is why I have this show, because I like to get together with and talk to people about religion things. And so I'm super curious if you can tell us a little bit about your Rinzai priest Zen grandmother, and who was, as I understand, the first foreigner to be a Rinzai priest, right?
Right.
So can you?
I think she might have been even the first foreigner to be ordained a Zen Buddhist priest.
I mean, that's really amazing. I mean, that has.
Yeah.
You know, can you tell me a little bit about her and her life at Daitokuji? Because I know that you lived there for a while too.
Right. Well, she was kind of an unusual young woman. She majored in Sanskrit in college at the University of Chicago, and was very interested in Eastern religions. She was married, in those days there was often, especially in the sort of the more upper class echelons, marriages were arranged. And she, because she was kind of an oddball, they married her to my grandfather, who was 20 years her senior, a very highly respected and highly paid Chicago criminal lawyer. who had had polio as a child, and so he was crippled. But they traveled. She ended up visiting China and Japan, and in the early 30s, she met a Suzuki and in Japan and wanted to find out about how she could go about learning about Zen Buddhism. And he introduced her to Nanshin Kenroshi of Nanzenji Temple in Kyoto. And she eventually was able to convince the temple there to take her on as a disciple. She spent 3 years there and was eventually allowed to sit meditation with the monks and continued her studies there. When she left, eventually she left there and came back to the United States. My mother, her daughter, was a teenager, and she wanted to take her to England to study piano with this famous pianist there. And that's when she met my father. They went to the Buddhist Society of London and met my father there, and that's how that happened. So, but she eventually, after she came back to New York, and then my father and my mother, after they were married, they right at the outbreak of World War II, came to the United States, and at that point, my grandmother had met Sogyan Sasaki, who was a Zen Buddhist priest of the Rinzai sect that was living in New York and had a small group called the New York Buddhist Society, I think was the original name, which eventually became the first Zen Institute in America. And they formed a bond. She, you know, was very interested in his work, and he was translating medieval colloquial Chinese Zen texts, and she became involved in that, and they worked on that pretty extensively until he was interred because of the war and as a enemy alien. Mm-hmm. And after he was released from prison, they were married, and he lived only for about 10 months after that. The prison basically broke his health. So after the occupation in Japan, she went back over there, and she found some scholars and continued to pursue their work that they had begun. And she published a few, I think maybe three books, the Zen Koan, Zen Dust, and there's one other, and I can't think of the title of it at the moment. But there's a book coming out in January. Well, that's this month.
Yeah.
From Wisdom Press. And it's called Zen Odyssey, which is a story of my grandmother and Sogyan Sasaki. And it's pretty interesting. A friend of mine has actually done it. She did a lot of research. I guess she's been working on it for about 10 years or more. And it's finally out. So, and then one of her other books, Zen Dust, was reissued in the modern Chinese Pinyin. And that was done by an Australian publisher. And it's a pretty hefty tome as well. So anyway, that's...
Are your grandmother's books out under her name, Ruth Sasaki?
Yes, they are.
Excellent. Yeah. So what did you like about... you lived at her temple for a while, didn't you?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What is your best memory about that?
Well... I think my experience of living in Japan was amazing. I mean, I lived there for 2 years, and I absolutely loved it. And I was a young adult at the time. I ended up getting married over there to a naval officer. It was quite different, of course, from living in the United States. I was living in a Japanese-style house. I had to learn to speak Japanese. I studied painting because that was what I seemed to be gifted in, and traveled around, visited many temples and so on, and just loved the culture. To me, it was just lovely. And I think one of the things I mentioned in the book was that, my father didn't get to Japan until after I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in his autobiography, mentions the sound of rain, and that was one of the things that I absolutely loved, was the sound of rain and the mist, walking through temple grounds. I would just go out and walk in the rain. It was so beautiful.
Beautiful. So the book, it describes a lot of the artifacts that Alan had. Like, he's got like temple gongs and amazing kimonos, and the pictures in the book are spectacular. He's got so many neat little artifacts mentioned throughout the book and in the letters. Do you have any of these artifacts? Like, what are your favorite things? Do you have any like physical things of his that you really cherish?
I have a few things. I'm just trying to think what I had a wonderful pair of wooden gaita that my father used to wear when he'd step out the door of his place in, on the mountain in Mill Valley. And I actually gave those to my one of my grandsons for a graduation present. And he was absolutely tickled. It was an odd gift to give, and I didn't know how he would respond, but he just absolutely loved it. I have a kimono that he wore often, and sash. And I have some of the pictures that he painted. Mm-hmm. He was a talented artist as well. And what else do I have? I have some small things, things that he had growing up, even. I have some pretty Chinese plates that his mother had been given from parents of students. She taught missionary students, missionary families, children. And they often brought gifts back from Asia to her. And so I have a few things like that. My brother has a Buddha that was on the little altar in his library. I have some silk, Chinese silks and things like that. It's hard for me now to remember which was my grandmother's and which was
right.
My father's sometimes. So
I always
I'm getting so old I can't remember.
In the book, I really like that there's like this playful rivalry almost between your grandmother and Alan.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, that seemed really. But they kept in touch. So even after your parents had separated, he kept in touch with the Zen priest Ruth Sasaki. I found that to be really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think he had a lot of respect for her, and she did for him in many respects. I mean, she, I remember, I think it was The Way of Zen when that came out. I was living in Japan. In fact, I had provided him with photographs of the rock garden at Ryoanji for the book. And I know she, made notations in the margins about things that he said. It was very amusing. I think I gave that book to him after she passed away. It was something that came to me through my mother. Unfortunately, the letters, he must have handwritten the letters to her, because what he wrote to her wasn't in the file, her letters to him were. And so I was kind of disappointed that we didn't see the originals that he wrote. But I suspect that he hand-wrote them instead of typed them.
So can we talk about the 60s for a few minutes?
Sure.
So that's kind of like Alan's, like, his era, like what he's best known for. So I'm 34. I was born in 1983, and I wasn't alive in the 60s, so I am curious about that time. Why do you think Alan's voice resonated so much in the 1960s?
Well, I think he became a member of the counterculture himself, and you know, with his interest in psychedelics and so on, I think that was part of it. And I think, on the other hand, too, that people in the 60s were looking to break out of their religious box, and they were looking at other ways of religion. I think that was, of course, during the time when some of the Maharishi or whatever people were coming to the country, and people were getting interested in meditation and different types of Eastern religions.
And when Alan was getting really famous in the 60s, you were living in Indiana, right?
Well, I lived briefly in Indiana, and then I lived in Ohio, in Baton, Ohio area.
Did you see Alan's books in bookstores while you were living in the Midwest, or had the Midwest not gotten there yet?
Oh, no, they were definitely there, and I generally kept quiet about that he was my father. Not for any particular reason other than I was kind of shy, you know, and if somebody found out I was the daughter of Alan Watts, the reaction was always kind of interesting, like anything from, as I say in the foreword of the book, you know, you seem too ordinary to be the daughter of Alan Watts, or may I kiss your feet, you know, I mean, the reaction was always very interesting, and I would always plan a lecture for him, you know, and they were always well attended, and it was pretty interesting, even in the Midwest.
So, like, one of the things that I'm interested in the book is, so I'm reading another one of his books right now, and it's one of his Introduction to Meditation, and your brother Mark wrote the foreword for it. And it's a small book. It's just a collection of letters or lectures in his later years. So in the letters collection that you edited, Alan does not really seem to talk about his own Zen practice. So did he have a strict Zazen practice that he would do every day?
No.
Okay. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about his practice, because it's just something that I'm really curious about. It seems to be like a gap in his letters.
Well, I think that he felt very strongly that you didn't have to sit Zazen for many hours in order to reach enlightenment, that you could... I think it's more kind of like mindfulness that people talk about now, that you know, he could sit for brief periods and, you know, or walk. He liked to liken his meditation to walking. And those were more the things that he was involved with rather than sitting cross-legged on the floor for many hours in a semi-darkened room with a bunch of other people doing the same thing. So
if he could do it all, like if he could do his, you know, how he was a priest, do you think if he could do it all over again, that he would become a Zen monk of some kind?
I don't think so.
Maybe that life wasn't for him.
He enjoys the other trappings of life too much.
Gotcha.
Culinary, you know, parties, gatherings, discussions, you know, as I said at the beginning of our conversation here, he was somewhat of a bon vivant. You know, he just enjoyed participating in lively discussions and artistic things and music things and so on, culinary, whatever.
An appreciator of all of the arts, it seems.
Yeah.
So there's been, as you mentioned a moment ago, mindfulness has swept the world, and there is a new body of research led by some professors in neuroscience labs around the world talking about the brain benefits of meditation and how it shows signs that it could potentially slow down aging in the brain. And I'm thinking about the work of Daniel Goleman and Richard Davidson that I sent to you in that email. What do you think Alan would say about the neuroscience research in meditation today? Like, do you think he'd be surprised, or do you think he'd be like, "I told you so"?
Oh, I told you so. I don't think he'd be terribly surprised, but I think also that he would be very interested. He was certainly very involved in the neuroscience aspects of psychedelic drugs, and was in touch with various brain specialists at the time, and psychologists and psychiatrists and so on. I know he spoke at different symposiums and so on with groups of people of that ilk, and would be totally fascinated with whatever research might be going on with that aspect.
In his later years, his lifestyle seemed to get away from him, like with drinking and smoking. And so that the book takes you into a facet of his life that a lot of readers maybe don't know much about. And in one really shocking encounter with you, he said that he would commit suicide any way that he wanted. And that must have been like a hugely shocking and traumatic experience for you. How did you handle things like this? Was this ever dealt with again? Like, what are your thoughts on these kinds of moments today?
Well, it's a sad situation. So many people today still don't fully understand the disease of addiction and the difficulty of getting out of it. I've seen that in my own life, not personally, but some people around me who, including my father, of course, but, you know, that was kind of my first window into the problem. But the inability to realize that it's not just you that your addiction is affecting, but it's also the people around you. And I think that, you know, that was very, I don't think he fully understood that when we saw him in that state, it was heartbreaking. And, but he was so entrapped in it that he could not see that, I think, is basically what happened. You know, he's frustrated by it. And he can't admit that, but, you know, frustrated that he can't stop. He can't just say, "I'm not going to do this anymore." I mean, he tried. He did stop smoking for a brief period, and he stopped drinking a couple of times, both times ending up in the hospital with BTs. Mm-hmm. And that was scary, too. So, you know, I think for anybody that has an addiction like that, it's just a terrible thing, and it's terrible to get out of it.
Yeah.
And if you're not an addictive person, it's like, I'm not an addictive person. And so it was very hard for me to understand, you know, why you can't just say, "I'm not going to do this anymore," and stop.
Right. And then his life ended prematurely at the age of 58. And
right.
His funeral was famously held at the Green Gulch Farm. And which was presided over by Richard Baker Roshi, the Dharma heir of Shunryu Suzuki, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. Can you kind of describe your memories of that day, the funeral?
I don't remember a lot about the day at this point. We had a small family funeral first, and then what I remember most is the 100-day celebration, because that was when his ashes were interred on the hillside above Green Gulch, and there was a stupa erected, a nice stone that had been found and moved there to mark his spot. And I remember the processions of people, the many guests that arrived for the ceremony. I remember people like Gary Snyder reading. I think James Broughton read also something they had written for him. And so I remember all that. It was, a very, lots of incense, a very ceremonious day. I remember Baker Roshi with his whisk of horsehair, I think it is, presiding over the ceremony, and Claude Dahlenberg, another priest there. That's kind of what I remember.
So as we bring our conversation to a close today, as Alan's daughter, what are some of your favorite pieces of wisdom that you've gleaned from him? And because he seems to be one of the most curious people who ever lived. I mean, you couldn't find a more well-read person and a more broadly studied person, it seems, than Alan Watts. So what are some of your favorite pieces of wisdom that you've gleaned from being his daughter?
It's hard to say that it was a piece of wisdom, but I think that I certainly inherited a curiosity about things, that I'm never bored.
Yeah, I'm not either.
I've always got something going on, something to do. I'm pretty open. I know my friends are always astonished that I'm the age I am, that they always find me sort of their age, which might be 50 or 60, and I'm on the cusp of being 80. So it's really interesting. I'm always fascinated with stuff. I mean, I learned, for instance, how to use a computer, how to program, how to do a website. I've stayed technologically active. I still paint. I write. I'm involved in all kinds of things. And I think, my father was like that too. I mean, he would, it's like he got an interest in various things that he would just continue to explore, and new things, quantum physics, whatever was kind of a new thing he would delve into. And of course, his curiosity about drugs.
Sure.
Things like that, and how all that works.
I could see Alan being like 113 years old right now, like writing code on websites.
I'm not sure he would do that. I think he might have other things that might be more interesting on that, but that's a little too practical and scientific, maybe. I don't know. But I do have to say, given his scholastic ability, I mean, that was one of the things that would just blew me away in reading his early letters in particular, was that this man was a scholar. He was incredibly intelligent and absorbed information like Christian doctrine and Latin and Greek and all of these different things he excelled in it. I mean, he was incredibly good at that. And certainly his understanding of Eastern philosophies as well. He was just a sponge of sorts for all that kind of information and learned it well.
Well, Joan, I just want to say one more time that I absolutely loved your collected letters of Alan Watts that you edited together with your sister. It is a remarkable journey into a life, and I hugely encourage everybody to buy the book and learn about this life and take away Alan's curiosity and apply it to something that you love as well. And I'm so grateful to you for spending this hour with me to talk about the life of your father, Alan Watts.
Well, thank you. I've certainly enjoyed it.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is performed and composed by Derek Streibig. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you would like to support this show, please subscribe or leaving a rating in iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.